Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Trump administration continues to slam the door on immigrants. On Sunday, Donald Trump tweeted he'd be willing to shut down the government if the Democrats do not vote to fund his wall. He also threatened to eliminate a diversity visa lottery, which allows people from countries with low immigration rates to obtain a visa. He's also called for an end to family migration, and that allows green card holders or those with citizenship to sponsor a family member for immigration to the U.S. Trump has also announced his administration would end temporary protected status for immigrants from a number of countries impacted by disaster or conflict. Those include El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Sudan. Criteria for obtaining H-1B work visas have also been tightened. So how is all of this playing out on the ground, and what options do people have? Today, we are joined by two guests who specifically follow these policies. Julia Gillette is senior policy analyst studying the U.S. immigration system with the Migration Policy Institute, and Julia joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Kevin Appleby is Senior Director of International Migration Policy at the Center for Migration Studies in New York. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. Well, let's start off by talking about some basic questions here. Julia, let's start off with you. Is it possible at this point to estimate how many immigrants have been blocked from coming here under these specific changes?
Well, as you mentioned, there have been a large number of changes, and they're all affecting different populations. And so I think at this point we don't have the full data on all of the numbers, but there are pieces that we can see. For example, the travel ban that is in place and that the Supreme Court has said is okay to go forward has led to a really steep decline in people coming from the seven affected countries, both those coming on permanent visas and those coming on temporary visas. And another piece we can easily see is the refugee arrivals. As you mentioned, there's a new low cap for refugees of 45,000. That's the lowest cap that's ever been set since the program was created in 1980. But refugee arrivals are actually on pace to not even get to that cap. If the current trends continue, we expect to see fewer than 22,000 refugees coming in. So these various policies are affecting various immigrant populations and the numbers coming in.
And Julia's line is a little low. We're going to see if we can bring her line up from her end in D.C. Kevin, what would you add? Do we know how many immigrants have been blocked from coming here under these changes?
Yeah, as Julia mentioned, we have bits and pieces from different programs that we can point to. For example, in terms of green card applications being approved in 2017, those were down 9%. And so far, within 2018, they're down 12%. Julia mentioned the refugee program and how that has impacted Muslim-majority countries. In FY16, we had 12,000 Syrian refugees admitted under the Obama administration, and this year only 49. So you're seeing an impact over time on the numbers. We don't have an aggregate number for every, you know, program that the administration administers, but we see a definite trend of downturn that will only continue the next couple of years.
And who are these policies specifically affecting?
Well, I mean, a whole wide range of nationalities. The travel ban, of course, focused upon primarily Muslim-majority countries that were part of the travel ban. So those specific from those countries have been particularly impacted. But even migration from other Muslim-majority countries that weren't on the travel ban has gone down because of the creation of a culture within USCIS and within the State Department by this administration that get to know as opposed to get to yes. In previous years and in previous administrations, the presumption was unless there's really major red flags for someone as a national security threat, that they would probably be admitted. Now, there's much more scrutiny, there's much more discretion for officers to say no to certain nationalities. It's hard to oversee, and Congress hasn't provided that oversight. So what you're seeing is a reduction in numbers. And I might also add that some of these policies, such as the removal of TPS, family-based immigration cuts, those are mainly used by nationalities that come from maybe poorer countries as opposed to, for example, European countries that are more wealthy. In fact, the number of green cards for Europeans has gone up this year, whereas other nationalities have gone down. So you see that the impact here is really on those from more poor countries and frankly, those of color.
Well, I think that is a very important point, because I was wondering how these policies affect Europeans. And so you're saying that the number of green cards from Europeans has actually gone up.
Well, and the total numbers of European green cards are not as high as from other countries such as Mexico, parts of South America, in the aggregate. But since the last 2 years, they have increased somewhat, whereas other nationalities have gone down, which is significant, because if the policy was, you know, across the board, then you'd also see a reduction in European visas as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because the rhetoric that we hear from the Trump administration, that Mexicans are rapists, talking about gangs, they're bad people. I mean, so much of this is racist. And so this rhetoric does kind of mirror the policies that we're seeing from this administration.
Well, I think so, and I think the administration, of course, would deny this and say that they apply these policies unilaterally. But if you look at what their pronouncements have been, what their initiatives have been, eliminating TPS, trying to eliminate the family immigration system, the elimination of the diversity lottery system, which they want, which impacts largely impacts African nations. That direction is goes in a way where you're going to limit the numbers coming from, as I said, poorer countries. The president has used more colorful language in that regard, as we know, and would favor those who have more resources, have more skills. And the president has been consistent that he wants to move away from the family-based immigration system to a merit-based immigration system. Based on a point system where it would depend on, you know, your skills, your wealth, et cetera. And that tends to favor, you know, more highly developed countries, people coming from those areas.
Julia, what would you add about this? Kevin was just saying that the majority of the people who are affected by these policies come from Muslim-majority countries, African countries, poor countries. We don't see these policies having a huge effect on European countries, for example.
Yeah, you can definitely see this in the countries that were listed in the travel ban. And then there are the 11 countries from which refugees are getting extra screening. Those are also predominantly Muslim-majority countries. So where we're seeing the declines in immigration are from these countries that are on the travel ban list, that are on the refugee extra screening list. In addition, we have this public charge provision that is coming down the pipeline. So the administration has signaled that they're intending to change how immigrants are labeled as a public charge. This is someone who is determined to be too dependent on the government to qualify for a visa. And the way that that proposed rule has been written, or the drafts that we've seen that have leaked so far, suggest that education and income are going to be important considerations for who will be allowed to immigrate to the country. And we don't yet know how this will play out. We haven't seen the official language, but it could be another force that's really meaning that immigration is much more possible from more developed countries where people have higher incomes, higher assets, and it will be more difficult to come from less developed countries.
Well, that was another question we wanted to ask, is one of the policies of U.S. immigration is based on a merit system. So who gets preferential treatment under the Trump administration? Julia, do you want to take that first?
Sure. So the president has endorsed a proposal that would create a so-called merit-based system. Essentially, this proposal would cut legal immigration in half by cutting many family-based categories. And on the employment side, it would create a merit-based system where people have to get a certain number of points in order to be able to qualify to immigrate to the United States. And those points would be based on things like English ability, achieving a certain percentile ranking on an English test. It would be based on educational attainment with higher points awarded for higher education, particularly in STEM, science, technology, and math fields. And more points would be awarded for those who are of working age. And so this is the intention is to allow immigration of those who can, you know, hit the ground running in the United States and really contribute economically. But the effect could be that it would be easier to come from certain countries than others. People who come from English-speaking countries, which may or may not be European countries, would have an easier time coming. Those with more developed educational systems, better access to education, would likely have an easier time coming as well.
And Kevin, what would you add to that?
No, I agree with that analysis. I mean, you know, we can talk about the intent here, but I mean, basically, this type of system would focus on class, as a, you know, where you are in the economic food chain, what you can do to contribute to the country as opposed to what the country can do for you. You know, creating immigrants in the administration's own image is really what they're trying to do, whether that's based on class or other considerations, that's the movement. But, you know, and the president, he talks from both sides of his mouth sometimes because he says, well, look at Canada, look at Australia. But the other time he says how unique the United States is. Well, the U.S. is not Canada and Australia. We have the largest economy in the world. We're going to have worker shortages, and we're starting to see that in certain industries for lower skilled labor, and that's going to only worsen over the next 20 to 25 years. So if you transfer to a merit-based system where you have more high skilled people coming in and you don't have other skill levels to sort of fill in those important industries, the economy is not going to grow to the extent we want it. So in reality, this what he's trying to do, or where he's trying to move us, will undercut our economic growth in the decades ahead, not help it. In a lot of ways, it's about class, I would say, more than anything else.
Kevin Appleby is Senior Director of International Migration Policy at the Center for Migration Studies in New York. Julia Gillette is Senior Policy Analyst studying the U.S. immigration system with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And today we are talking about how Donald Trump's hardline immigration policy is playing out on the ground and who is most affected by this. As Kevin said, class is a huge factor. We're also seeing Muslim majority countries greatly affected, poor countries, African countries. If you have any questions or comments specifically about these types of immigration policies, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have firsthand experience, if you've recently gone through the immigration process of obtaining a green card or a visa, if you're trying to sponsor a family member, for so many people, they cannot see their family members for the first time. If you have a story, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, tweet us at yourcallradio. And then later in the show, we will discuss a new ProPublica report about sexual abuse at detention centers holding immigrant children. Let's talk a little bit about how people who live in war-torn countries or countries that have been through horrific disasters are being affected by the administration's policies. Julia, what changes have we seen there?
Well, as we've discussed, there is a much lower cap on refugee admissions. So people who have fled their country, who were hoping to be able to find safety in the United States, those possibilities are much more limited, particularly if they're from countries that are under extra screening. And Syria is one of those countries, as Kevin mentioned. In addition, temporary protected status is being ended for many countries. So this is a program that allows people who are in the United States when violence breaks out or when there's a natural disaster in their country, it allows them to stay on a temporary basis, to get work authorization, to be protected from deportation. But TPS has been ended by this administration for a number of countries, for El Salvador, for Honduras, for Haiti, and these are the countries that make up the bulk of TPS holders in the United States. So over the coming years, as these programs sunset, we'll see that about over 90% of those who currently have TPS will lose that protected status within the United States.
How long have we had TPS?
It was part of the 1990 Immigration Act, a provision that was put in. And the intent, which is really was ahead of its time, because we see the world is debating migration right now, and temporary protected status is a tool that can be used globally to protect populations who may not qualify for refugee status or other type of status, but because of conditions in their countries, natural disasters or conflict, then they're unable to return. I might add to Julia's comments is that these are not these nationalities under TPS. They're not people that came yesterday. They've been here for years and decades. They own homes. They have U.S. citizen children. I think 273,000 U.S. citizen children throughout the country. They're well employed, so they have a lot of equities in the country. So we've really given them protection for a couple of decades in a couple of cases, and now we're just pulling the rug out from them and say, despite what you've contributed to this country, you're going back. So I would disagree with how the administration is administering the program and whether it's in our best interest or in the interest of the countries that are, many of whom are our allies. And, you know, you saw reports that the U.S. embassies in some of these countries, pleaded through the State Department not to end these programs because the countries can't take it. So we'll see how it plays out, but it's really a situation where we're really cutting off our nose to spite our face.
So, Kevin, if TPS holders, people who've been here for a long time who have kids here, how is this administration deciding who to deport?
Well, many of these countries, they've been given a 1-year grace period before their status is revoked. I don't see DHS, saying, okay, we're going to go find every Haitian in the country and deport them. But it makes them vulnerable to being, arrested by ICE officers within the interior of the country, just going about their own business. So, they'll just determine by who can't demonstrate that they're, they have legal status, and they'll be starting to be deported. I don't think there'll be a roundup of different nationalities, but they'll be vulnerable to deportation and have to live in fear, and many will have to go into the shadows because they really don't have homes where they come from anymore. They've been here for so long, and the countries aren't able to receive them. I mean, Haiti has been recovering from natural disasters, is the poorest country and one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere. Honduras and El Salvador, they have, as we've been well chronicled, have violence from gangs. So it's really a predicament where these nationalities who have built equities, built families, will be at risk of deportation and will have to live in the shadows.
Mm. Has any other administration ended TPS?
There have been smaller TPS populations that have had TPS on a shorter basis, and those programs have ended. So there have been, quite temporary grants to a small group, and then that TPS was ended. But I believe that this is the first time that so many people will be affected by ending of TPS. There are currently over 300,000 people in the United States who have TPS protections, and I believe it's 98% of them are expected to lose their TPS if the end of the program that they're on really does go forward over the next 2 years.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Real quick. I mean, this administration, you know, tries to make its mark by decrying illegal immigration. But they have created more undocumented immigrants than any administration. There are over a million people that they've thrown out of legal status. So, in fact, the number of undocumented in this country is increasing under this administration, not decreasing, because they're unraveling programs that provide protection to long-term residents who haven't been able to get a permanent status yet but live under legal status. So it's an irony of this administration that they tout themselves as being tough on illegal immigration, but the number of undocumented has actually increased since they took office.
Well, we have a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to talk about the conflicts that drive people out in so many of these countries are the result of U.S. intervention. And we've done a lot of shows about this. There's an amazing documentary called Harvest of Empire that looks at individual countries in Central and South America, like El Salvador, like Honduras, Guatemala, and looks at U.S. foreign policy there and interviews people in those countries that talk about how, for example, U.S. support of dictators forced her to leave because her father was a political prisoner. I mean, there's so many stories like this. What about that part of this, Kevin? I mean, that piece, even though we talk about it on a regular basis, it definitely bears reporting. I mean, there's a reason why people are fleeing their home countries.
Well, sure. Well, let's take Central America, for example, where we're seeing, of course, this controversy over the family separation and the families coming from the Northern Triangle, which has happened over the last 4 years. There's really a case to be made that, you know, the U.S. has had a hand in the situation in these countries. We're certainly, you know, the big drug market for the drug cartels that sort of drive the violence there. Many of the weapons that they have made in the USA on them. And a lot of the origins of some of these gangs can be traced back to the U.S., Los Angeles area, for example. But as you mentioned, we also have been supporting right-wing dictatorships there for the last 30 to 40 years, which has spurred a sort of a culture of impunity, if you will. In these countries, there's corruption. There's an absence of the rule of law. If you're prospective victim of a gang, for example, a mother with children or a young woman or a young man trying to be recruited to the gangs, you have really no recourse to go to the courts to get justice here, because first of all, you'll be retaliated against by the gangs, but also there's corruption involved in these areas with the police and others. It's rare that a gang member is going to be sent to jail over threatening someone's life. So I mean, we really need to look hard at ourselves in the mirror and say, okay, we cannot blame these countries for their predicament alone. We had a hand in it. You know, we're the most powerful nation in the world and, of course, in the hemisphere. And we've had a hand in where these countries are now, and we need to fix it over the long term. And that means addressing the root causes and really paying attention to that for 5 to 10 years. That's the only sustainable way to solve the issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Appleby is Senior Director of International Migration Policy at the Center for Migration Studies in New York, and Julia Gillette is Senior Policy Analyst studying the U.S. immigration system with the Migration Policy Institute. And we should also add trade policies to that list, because we've also talked about how NAFTA affects people, especially women workers in Mexico, how companies jump the border and pay $1 or $2 an hour, which obviously does not allow people to feed their families, and so many come to the U.S. to find better paying jobs. Today we are talking about immigration policies. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the Affordable Care Act, which is under attack by the Trump administration. They have not completely repealed it, but they're undermining the law piece by piece. So we will talk about how these changes are affecting access to health care. And on our media roundtable, we will be discussing the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about the hardline immigration policies coming from the Trump administration. There have been a lot of stories about the young man behind the policies, Stephen Miller, and then Jeff Sessions, who's behind the separation of children and their families at the border. And we're talking today about various changes to immigration policy. For example, an end to family migration. The administration has lowered the ceiling from refugee admissions. It's announced it would end temporary status for immigrants from many countries, El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan, just to name a few. We're joined today by Julia Gillette, senior policy analyst studying the U.S. immigration system with the Migration Policy Institute. Kevin Appleby is senior director of international migration policy at the Center for Migration Studies. And before we get a call, Julia, I wanted to know if you wanted to add anything to the point a caller made before the break about how it's so important to talk about U.S. policies. And in many cases, it's U.S. policies that are forcing people to flee.
Well, I just want to add to what was being said before about kind of the conditions in the region. We know that in the Northern Triangle of Central America, in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, there's a lot of gang violence related to the drug trade. We also know that policing is not always super effective. And so we have a lot of asylum seekers who are coming from those countries to the United States seeking safety from that gang violence, or women seeking safety from domestic violence when the local police can't protect them. But one thing I wanted to note about other policy changes is that the Attorney General Jeff Sessions has recently issued a ruling that will make it a lot harder for people to get asylum in the United States based on those precise claims, based on experiences of gang violence or based on fleeing domestic violence. And so with this change, it's expected that many fewer people who come to the United States from Central America will actually win their asylum cases and be able to seek safety here.
How are the governments of these countries dealing with these crises? Like, for example, gang violence, domestic violence. Are we seeing any changes, or is anything being done about this in Honduras and Nicaragua and El Salvador? Julia?
I'm less familiar with the actions that are being taken by those governments. I believe that there are steps that are being taken. I believe that, you know, the United States as well is trying to support efforts in judicial reform and police reform. But I think it's a long battle. I think it's difficult when the power of the gangs and transnational gangs is as strong as the state in some areas. It can be a long road to make the kind of changes that will allow people to live in safety and to be able to trust the local police.
Right. Kevin?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the capacities of some of these governments are limited. They're poor countries. They don't have the resources necessarily to provide services to their population, to provide employment opportunities, especially for young people. You know, you see unaccompanied minors coming. It's partially because they're certainly being recruited by the gangs, but and a lot of times that's the only game in town. You know, they don't have a future. So when you combine that with, you know, the violence threat, you try to go somewhere else. And what we need to do is strengthen the capacities of these governments and hold them more accountable, especially in terms of the corruption and the, you know, mm-hmm. the confluence of the government with the gangs. They've taken some initiatives with force in some cases, which you know, they've had wars with the gangs in certain instances, but that's not a long-lasting solution. What you need to do is transform the society so that young people primarily have more of an opportunity to live their life in dignity and security. And that's going to take time, and it's going to need U.S. help.
Well, let's take a few callers. Let's hear from Marion in San Francisco. Hi, Marion. Welcome to the show. Do we have Marion? Let's try Marta in San Francisco. Hi, Marta. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah,
you're on the
air. I was listening to your show. I just wanted to mention that I actually just got my green card through employment, but it took like 1 year longer than what we were expecting, and I'm seeing this trend happening to a lot of my high-skilled immigrant friends. We're seeing a lot of changes with this administration. We are seeing the big news of the border, but there are also like all these tiny policy changes that are constant and then look very technical, but they're affecting the lives of thousands of people. Not only that, but also we're seeing like a more and more collapse administration that is incorporating like months of wait, and that's affecting a lot of us. We are obviously among the most privileged immigrants you are going to find. I just got my green card. It took me way longer than what I was expecting, but I have it. And if it hadn't worked, I would have gone back to my country. I'm from Europe. I speak several languages. I hold 2 master's degrees. I'm going to be fine. This is not going to be like, it's not going to ruin my life. But at the same time, I've been here for years. My friends are here. My boyfriend is American. I like my job. And it's like this constant narrative that immigrants, of all kinds of immigrants, no matter if we are undocumented, if we are high skilled, if we are anything, are here like to cause damage to this country. Well, we're not. We're just trying, all of us, trying to work and make our lives and like, I don't know, just like live like everybody else.
And Marta, based on experiences of your friends, before this administration came to power, how long did it take them to get a green card?
That really depends. Like, it can vary from a few months if you're an European scientist with a PhD to, like, many years if you are, like, an Indian immigrant working in the tech industry. It really depends. But all of us are seeing, like, I don't know, conversation with our lawyers of, like, okay, what you thought it was going to work, now it's not going to work. Now you have to do this interview that you were not supposed to do. Now this is getting delayed for months and we don't know what to tell you. You have to repeat your medical exams. You have to prove again that you are not bringing tuberculosis to the country. Like, so it really varies, but it's affecting everybody. Of course, some people are way more affected than others. So for some, it's just right. going to be a matter of like months and uncertainty. For others, it's not. And it's just like, why is this happening?
Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, Marta. Julia, are you hearing this from other green card applicants?
Yes, it certainly rings true. What we've seen, as Marta mentioned, is that this administration is really taking a fine-tooth comb through our legal immigration policy and finding all kinds of places to tighten things up, to add extra vetting, to add extra fraud detection, to ask for more supplementary materials, more background information, social media information. The administration can't on its own cut the number of legal immigrants coming to the country. That's really Congress's job. But instead, they seem to be looking where they can to take this kind of law enforcement view of legal immigration and really tighten up the system everywhere it can be tightened. And that is affecting the time that it takes for people to get their visas. Processing times seem to be going up for some visas. Rejection rates are going up for some visas. So that really is affecting people who are waiting to get their visas on the ground.
Well, thank you for calling in, Marta. We have an email from a listener, Sandy, who says, Trump businesses are hiring foreign workers. Can you comment on this? She provided a link to a Washington Post piece earlier this month about Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club asking permission to hire 78 foreign workers to serve as cooks, waiters, and housekeepers during this winter's social season in Palm Beach, Florida. This is according to the Labor Department. Kevin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? The one category where the administration has increased the numbers of visas available is the H-2B program, which is a seasonal program, non-agricultural, but for workers that come in, you know, to do service, maybe to work in different areas of, you know, the seafood industry or other industries that are seasonal. They increased, the DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen increased it, the number from 66,000 to 81,000 this year. And then the Trump administration, as your the email suggests, asked for 78 workers subsequent to that. So it shows a bit of self-interest and a bit of hypocrisy, frankly, from the administration that they would increase this this number when they're slashing in other areas.
According to the Washington Post, Trump reported that Mar-a-Lago took in $25 million in revenue last year, and it pays housekeepers just under $11 an hour, $13 for cooks, and about $12.60 per hour for waiters. Final thoughts, Julia, what other changes do you see? Are you expecting further lawsuits? Where do you see this going?
There are a lot of potential changes on the horizon, a lot of them, again, in the weeds of immigration law. But we're looking for proposed rules to come out around the H-1B visa, further tightening that, perhaps taking away work authorization for the spouses, usually wives, of H-1B holders. That's the high-skilled temporary worker visa. As I mentioned earlier, there is a proposed rule that we expect redefining who counts as a public charge, and this could really reshape legal immigration to the country, who's allowed in, who's able to get a visa. So we're watching for quite a few things coming down the pipeline. This administration is exerting as much authority as it can over immigration from the administrative side, even while Congress, you know, doesn't have the appetite to take on the issue.
Kevin, what are you watching for?
Well, speaking of Congress, which we really haven't, you know, they have some culpability in all of this since they have an oversight function. Another group that we haven't talked about that's, believe it or not, under the radar are the DACA-eligible deferred action for childhood arrivals. And that could really come to the fore either later in the year or next year when the Supreme Court will likely rule on whether the administration can end that program. So we'll probably see some flurry of activity in Congress over that resolution. And also look for, certainly, the budget battle, which could occur in September, where the president will be demanding his immigration agenda, which includes cuts in legal immigration and funding for the wall, and whether he will shut down the government over that. That should be an interesting back-and-forth battle that we have to look forward to.
Kevin Appleby is Senior Director of International Migration Policy at the Center for Migration Studies in New York, and Julia Gillette is Senior Policy Analyst studying the U.S. immigration system with the Migration Policy Institute in D.C. Kevin and Julia, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're just getting some breaking news that is related. The Los Angeles Times reports that a federal appeals court decided 2-1 that the Trump administration cannot withhold federal funds from immigrant-friendly sanctuary cities and counties. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a district judge's ruling in favor of San Francisco and Santa Clara County, which sued over the administration's threats to withhold money to jurisdictions that have passed laws limiting local law enforcement cooperation with federal immigration authorities. And now I would like to welcome Michael Graybell to the show. Michael and his colleague Topher Sanders wrote a story for ProPublica last week about sexual abuse at immigration youth shelters. Hi, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on and bringing attention to this story.
Well, I was horrified like so many when I read this, but before we dive in and talk about your piece, just to give people some context, The Nation had another disturbing article yesterday called "The U.S. Deported 468 Parents But Kept Their Children." I mean, this is another just shocking story. So at this point, there are about 468 children who are in this country without their parents. Have you also been following, 650 actually. Have you been following this piece of the story, Michael?
Yes. You know, there's been different numbers that have come out. I think the most recent that I saw was, I've seen both 650 and 711 reported of the number of children that are still in the shelters that were separated from their families. And a large portion of those, as you mentioned, more than 400, are ones where their parents had already been deported. There was a hearing yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee where there was some discussion and there's some argument about whether those parents deported believing that they were going to meet their kids at the airport and be deported together, and whether they may have been misinformed in waiving their rights to be deported with their children or to be reunited with their children in voluntarily departing.
And according to this piece, Ashley Hebner, Associate Director of Legal Services for the National Immigrant Justice Center, said, quote, "There is no effort being made by the government to fix the situation. Each day, it just becomes more obvious how their role has been abdicated," end quote. And then the piece also focuses on a four-year-old boy whose father was deported to Honduras in June, and he's now in hiding in Honduras. The father left because of repeated threats from a drug trafficker who'd been involved in the murder of his cousin. He sought asylum in Brownsville, but he was never given a credible interview, according to a legal declaration. When the father got to Honduras, he was trying to talk to his son by phone. He finally got in touch with him, and he said, finally, when I spoke with him, he said he didn't want to talk to me because he said I had left him there. This is his four-year-old son. I mean, this is just one story. I'm sure very common.
Yeah, well, we're hearing a lot about our children coming out of these shelters, and they've now face a traumatic experience that was brought on them by U.S. authorities, and in some ways are very much changed and are going to have to go through some therapy, some counseling to process what they went through being separated from their parents.
And is that therapy, is any kind of help available for these kids?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the story that you reported for ProPublica. You were able to get your hands on a number of documents, police reports and call logs concerning more than 70 of the approximately 100 immigrant youth shelters run by the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So these are state public record laws?
Yeah, state public record laws. In most cases, when something happens at one of the facilities, they are required to report, call the police, and the police respond and take reports. So we went ahead, like you said, and requested from all of these different agencies how many times they've been out there, what kind of things they've been called about, and when we could get the police reports to find out what was going on in these shelters.
One source told you, quote, "If you're a predator, it's a gold mine," end quote. What really stood out for you in these reports?
Well, one of the things we saw, I mean, is really the vulnerability of these children. You know, that quote comes from a psychologist. So talking to psychologists, not only have a lot of these kids suffered traumatic experiences in their home countries or along the migration route, they're coming to the U.S. with little knowledge of our legal system, unable to speak English. They, you know, are desperate for some stability after this long journey and really not knowing who to trust. And so when they come into these shelters, if there is somebody there who wants to do them harm, they're very vulnerable. You know, they don't have access to lawyers or other people who can protect them. So they might seek that in a shelter worker. We talk about in the story how in one case, you know, the first person that the child met as a 15-year-old boy, you know, came into his room and one night and started tickling him, and then comes back again and begins to grope him and try to put his hand underneath his pants. And that youth care worker was eventually arrested and convicted for molesting the child.
Who are these youth care workers, and how are they screened?
So they are supposed to be screened very rigorously. They're supposed to get background checks. But one of the things, so on top of these kids being extremely vulnerable, coming into these situations, these shelters were never intended to be long-term group homes. These are not supposed to be residential facilities. But it, during the Trump administration, we have seen these the average length of stay for a child in the facility go from 34 days to 57 days, so a little more than a month to a little less than 2 months. So that's, so what people told us is that is a lot of time to develop these inappropriate relationships, for kids to kind of get anxious and desperate in the facilities and begin to act out. And on top of this, these shelters are having to constantly ramp up and ramp down depending on what the population is of the number of children coming in at the border. So it's a very difficult situation for to manage. Southwest Key, which is the largest provider of these shelters, the largest operator of these shelters, just laid off 1,000 employees last year, and a few months later they were ramping up to meet a surge. So you need to find bilingual mental health counselors. You need to find qualified youth care workers, and they're not, you know, these aren't obviously the best paid jobs in any economy. So it's a real mix of challenges that kind of lead to this environment.
You mentioned someone, a perpetrator who has faced consequences. Has anyone else? Is there any way of knowing?
That's what we're trying to find out, to get the full picture. The Trump administration has presented these as safe havens, that the kids are being well taken care of. We don't have a ton of evidence of that. The tours, the facilities, when the press tours are being done, or the tours members of Congress, they look fine. A lot of kids come out and say, my experience there was fine. But we don't have a full accounting of this. The Health and Human Services Department has years and years and years of serious incident reports that they have rarely, that they haven't really released to the public. There's been some rare instances of that. But that full accounting, as far as I know, has not been made to the press, has not been made to Congress. So what we are trying to do is begin to put that together through these police reports.
The reports that you collected so far show that in the past 5 years, police have responded to at least 125 calls reporting sex offenses at shelters that primarily serve immigrant children. You write that that number does not include another 200 such calls for more than a dozen shelters that also care for at-risk youth residing in the United States. So this is not new, because we're talking about the past 5 years. You mentioned that a major change under the Trump administration is that these children are staying for longer periods of time in these shelters. What other changes between the Obama administration and the Trump administration should we know about?
Right. And before I get to that, let me put those numbers in context. What we know is that these shelters are required to report anything that happens. So even some minor offenses that appear as only to be horseplay are being reported. However, the ones reports that we did find show inappropriate relationships with staff. We do have several other incidents of molestation or intercourse with staff members, and we do see kids being put in situations that they were trying to flee, essentially, you know, sexual violence, kids acting against other kids. And there's one story that we report out and document about a 15-year-old boy who was forced to have oral sex with another teenager at the facility.
Mm. Okay, so you say sexual relations. These are kids who are under 17, right?
Yes.
So they're being raped.
When they're having sexual intercourse with the staff. Sometimes it's just an inappropriate romantic relationship that hasn't gotten to that level.
Now, how can you talk about the process involved in this? If a child is harassed, sexually abused, what do they do? Who can they go to?
So they can go and they can go to their counselor, someone that they can trust at the facility. Hopefully, there's someone there they can do that to, or they can tell their parents, who sometimes do report it back to the shelter or to police. Now, there's supposed to be a lot of monitoring, either from the federal government and from the state agencies that license and regulate these shelters as child care facilities. Under the Trump administration, they sort of realized that this surge and fall in the numbers was a difficult situation. You know, if you remember, I mean, these shelters had very few kids in them until 2014, where we saw suddenly 60,000 kids arriving on the border unaccompanied. And they came up with a plan that they thought would better monitor these shelters. And they this happened at the end of the Obama administration in 2016 and 2017, and there were various recommendations of how the agency was going to be restructured to better watch what was going on. When I asked the Health and Human Services Department what was whether they had followed through, what they told me was that this had what had not been implemented by the previous administration, and that now you know, but now they are monitoring the situation every day. So it doesn't seem like there was a lot of specifics that they had followed through.
And Michael, final question. This story, like so many, has been shared many, many times. How are organizations who are advocating for these children, what are they doing about this? What can be done about this?
Well, so there's currently, I believe there's currently a lawsuit that is just about, you know, specifically about the conditions at these shelters. You know, there as children are being reunited with their families, we are starting to hear reports as to what their experiences were like in these shelters, including allegations of abuse, some cases that were not reported to the police. And this is something that we are trying to learn more about, trying to document as we have by getting more of these police reports. One thing I'd say is we still have not seen the full picture. While we have 70, we're still trying to get police reports from many, many agencies.
Michael Graybell and Topher Sanders wrote the ProPublica piece, Immigrant Youth Shelters, quote, "If you're a predator, it's a gold mine." And that quote came from Lisa Fortuna, director of child and adolescent psychiatry at Boston Medical Center. She says, you have full access and then you have kids that have already had this history of being victimized. It's a horrific story, but so important to expose. Thank you so much, Michael, for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the Affordable Care Act. While Republicans have failed to repeal it entirely, the administration is undermining the law piece by piece. It's withholding billions of dollars to help insurers provide coverage, and it's slashing grants to nonprofits that help people sign up for plans. But enrollment is overall, it's up, and so we'll talk about how these changes are affecting access to health care. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or podcast the show, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.